and record the call for the website. Welcome everyone to the forecaster conference. So we've got one more before we take a sort of 2 month break or a follow up. Today we're going to be talking about the survey process as it relates to incontinence management. I know a lot of you have questions. Jack is prepared to answer them at the end of the conference. Again, in our coaching calls, you guys continue to impress. Kate and I, we really enjoy talking with you in between sessions and getting feedback from you. It really helps us. We're learning a lot. I hope you're learning as much from us. With that, Jack, I will go ahead and give it to you, and I'll just remind you to prompt us as you move through the slides. I think right now we're on one. Shall we go on to two?
Yes, go on to two. It's titled Passing the Survey.
Okay, it's all yours.
All right, so let me give you a little background about my experience with the survey process. First, at UCLA, I was based at the Jewish Home for the Aging for 18 years, and I saw every survey that came through there since I was responsible for helping them pass the survey. So I had that experience, same experience you have. The experience you don't have is that we got a contract from CMS to evaluate the survey process because there was criticism that the survey process was very consistent. We did two things for them. First, we shadowed surveyors in five different states for a full week at the full time that they were there, documenting how they conducted investigations, what they did, what they didn't do, what their interpretations of things were. And then after that was done, we get a contract to evaluate the new survey process that they're trying out in several states, the QIS. So for that one, we actually took regulatory guidelines in five areas, and incontinence was being one of them. And we went into nursing homes at the same time that surveyors did. And we conducted an independent survey and then compared our results to what the survey results were. To see how accurate they were in picking up problems that we picked up. That required us to take the interpretive guidelines and make them very specific so that our nurses could use the protocols we came up with and look at a chart, do observations, and agree about what the quality was. Some areas, I might say, you should know, have never been trained to that point, amazingly to me, where they can take the interpretive guidelines and it's been demonstrated that two surveyors can use the same interpretive guidelines, look at the change chart, look at the same patient, and agree. There's no documentation that they've ever been trained to that point. We get that. To make a long story short, here's what we first, the survey regulations are very vague. So vague that the way they're written, they have to be made more specific if you hope to have two people agree about what kind of documentation meets the requirement or what kind of care meets the standard for a quality problem or not. And surveyors use very subjective and individual judgments to interpret these. In all our studies, different surveyors used very different definitions of, for instance, what individualized care plan meant, and emphasized these things in very different ways. Some people ignored it completely, some people really made a focus on it, which contributes to the inconsistency of the survey process. And particularly problematic are the regulations regarding choice and individualization, because these words, choice individualization, comes out in almost every care area now, particularly incontinence, but not incontinence only, in almost every area, and it's not that well defined. Now, by saying that, you have to do a caveat. I mean, for this job that I'm doing today, you requested examples of what I think are good care plans or things that would meet the survey requirements. If everything was clear and objective, first, you probably wouldn't even be asking me to do this, you'd already know. But secondly, if they were very clear and objective, it would be very easy to give you care plans and language that would meet the intent of the guidelines. But they're not. They're not that objective. So that's a problem. What I'm giving you today are what, in our experience, would be an outstanding airplane. I mean, we did these assessments in like I said, 5 states, 20 homes. And what I want to give you today are examples of care plans and assessment language that's much better than anything that we saw. Any place that we went. So because of that, I say that what I'm giving you today is an example of something that should meet every law in terms of the interpretive guidelines for what you're supposed to do with cottage care. Now, whether every surveyor would see it the same way, I don't know. The fact that they're so subjective and have different definitions and things makes this kind of problematic. But I can say that if I present this to you today and we have a discussion about it, that we have never seen care plans or assessment language better than what you're about to see. So let's just focus on a couple of the major things that surveyors are supposed to look at when you're looking at cottage care, particularly some of the more recent advice that have come out from CMS about what surveyors are supposed to look like for cottage care. And cottage care plans are supposed to be based on choice to be individualized, as Greg, I'll try to make it specific.
Are you on the next slide?
Yes, the next slide, I'm sorry. Regulatory language regarding incontinence care plan.
Thank you.
And you're supposed to identify the types of incontinence and base programs on voiding and elimination patterns. Now, what I don't have on this slide, these are two things that recently have come out that surveyors are supposed to look at, is there's also language that the care plans are supposed to be of sufficient, quote, specificity, unquote, so as to be easily implemented. I only bring that point up because that's pretty vague too, because there was a couple questions from somebody, or from maybe two people, prior to this presentation asking me about how specific to make language. What specifically should you say every 2 hours or something like that? And this speaks to this issue of specificity, and I'll try to elaborate a little bit more. However, I don't want to imply that these two things that I have on this slide, choice and individualized types of incontinence and basic program on elimination pattern, are the only things we're taught to look at. If you look at the next slide, narrative guidance to surveyors, points of emphasis, somebody I work with actually came up with this, Joe Offrander, who's an incontinence expert, and he identifies these things as the primary things that deficiencies were written for in the area of urinary incontinence. Resident choice again, whether it was clear that resident choice was being honored for the incontinence care program. Assessment for reversible factors and the types of incontinence, we talked about that. Targeted intervention is based on assessment, the lack of a toileting program, poor hygiene related to perineal care, UTI, urinary tract infections, whether they have indicators to treat or not, recurrent UTIs, the use of undiluted catheters with a medical necessity, without medical necessity, and poor catheter care. So all of those things are points of emphasis. We're primarily going to be talking about not urinary tract infections and catheters today, but the other points. Let's move to the next slide. It says checklist of assessments and care plans versus narratives. Now, it was quite typical in many of the homes that we were in that both assessments and care plans were handled in a checklisted fashion. What I mean by that is that, for instance, there'd be a sheet with a bunch of blocks listed along that would say type of incontinence. It would say UTI present or not, and they would just check all these boxes. And the care plan would be something similar. It would be some kind of standardized checklist format where for a particular patient, you would check off what you were doing. So you might check toileting every 2 hours, another block, changes needed, so on and so forth. Anyway, the care plan and assessment really didn't have narratives to it, like I'm going to give you today. I mean, it didn't have descriptions, paragraph language, summarizing these things. It pretty much just had checklisted boxes. Now, what about that? Well, it certainly is efficient, which is why people like to do it. but I think it opens you to the possibility of being accused that's not individualized. And I know you check off different boxes for different patients, but it still looks very generic. It doesn't have the flavor of being individualized, nor does it have the flavor of really considering people's choice. Would surveyors automatically write a deficiency if they saw that? The answer is unequivocally no. In most cases, they did not. However, in some cases, they did. And yet another project for CMS, we actually surveyed a big group of surveyors and asked them, would you consider a checklist sufficient to meet the urinary incontinence guidelines for assessment or for care plan? About 75% said that they would not consider it adequate, that they want more than that. Now again, it's not my experience that they're always operating on that, but I'm only saying that trying to get by just with checklisted forms for both the assessment and the care plan, I think is a little dangerous. It wouldn't take that much more time to do that, plus write a narrative summary for what the assessment is or for what the care plan is. And writing that narrative assessment, that narrative summary, clearly at least gives the flavor or the feeling that the much more personalized care plan or assessment protocol. So now the question comes, what would one look like? So let's go to the next slide that says suggested language for assessment. But what I've done today is pick three different examples of assessments and associated care plans to fit three types of situations that you specifically have asked about in the course of these lectures. One is an assessment care plan for somebody who put on a clothing program. That's the person we're discussing. The second is an assessment care plan for somebody who's not going to be on a clothing program. That's the second one I'll discuss. And then somebody asked, so what would one look like for urgent comments? So I'm giving you that as a third example. There are obviously more possibilities. And if you want me to discuss other possibilities, you can just ask a question about it. I'll do that and even write this example for you. So I think you can get an idea of the theme that I'm trying to get at here. And these three sets of examples I'm not going to give you. So let's look at the first one. Suggested language for assessment. This is an example of somebody who would be on a clothing program. So reading through that, resident was prompted every 2 hours, this is your 3-day trial basically, and given choice to use the bathroom with the prompted boarding protocol referenced in the interpretive guidelines. Okay, that sentence contains two words that surveyors I think would resonate to or look for. First is the word choice, and secondly, the prompted boarding protocol that's referenced in the interpretive guidelines. It is referenced in the interpretive guidelines. So when you make that sentence, you're basically saying, look, we did. You know, a protocol is referenced in the interpretive guidelines, and we gave people choice. The resident, the change is needed. The resident requested assistance 3 times per day, successfully used the toilet each time. The resident did not show stress weak each or a strong urgency, which suggests that she has functional incontinence. Okay, stop there for a minute. Remember, one of the things they look for is type of incontinence. So I have that captured in that sentence. But in previous lectures, I basically told you the difference between stress and urge incontinence. She was wet only once per day with a small void. The resident and the family expressed a preference to continue with the prompted voiding program, in which the resident is asked if she wants assistance but is given choice and control over her clothing frequency every 2 hours. All right. Again, what I'm trying to capture in that sentence is that this program is consistent with the preference of the family and resident, and again, even though it's redundant, but it's worth repeating, that this program involves choice. It means it's individualized. The resident gets choice and control, those are key, over the clothing frequency every 2 hours. There's no indication that the care can be made more efficient since there's no strong time counters before you see them. So what I'm saying is, I don't know what you're doing with your summers, with your results from this 3-day trial, but whatever you're doing, whatever checklist and cells you have in there, I have to do some one or two paragraph summary, like I just described. It's very difficult for me to believe that a surveyor could read something like that and make the conclusion that this program is not individualized, that it's not targeted to a resident's need, and that it's not based on choice and preference. I suggest the language for the care plan could be briefer. It could be resident to be offered coding assistance every 2 hours during waking hours from a prompt boarding protocol in which resident is asked if she wants assistance and encouraged to toilet. The program is individualized, that word again, based on the resident's need and desire for assistance.
You're actually on the next slide there.
I'm sorry, the next slide. I'm slipping.
Sorry.
Yes, I'm just suggesting language for care plan. The question came up about how specific this should be. You might be listening to the early 2 hours. Let me tell you your issue. The issue, again, is what I said at the beginning. They're instructed to look at how specific the care plans are, whether they're specific enough to be implemented. Here's a trade-off. The more specific you are, the more likely that you could be judged out of compliance. However, the less specific you are, if you write language like toileting as needed, or changed as needed, that's pretty non-specific, that leaves you open to the possibility of them saying that's not specific enough, or worse. What they're also taught to do, not that they always do this consistently, but what they're also taught to do is to identify a couple of residents and to observe them for at least a 2-hour interval. And if they don't see incontinence cured during that time, I forget the resident is wet or ask for assistance and don't get it. They're right in deficiency because they said, you said care as needed, and obviously we're wet, so they needed care and needed to give it to them. So what's the advice? I mean, it's a trade-off. I mean, I personally think you're safer by saying something's going to be done every 2 hours or in a later care plan. I put in that it's going to be done about every 2 hours. That might be a little better and give you a little wiggle room. But I think that's probably a safer way to go than the people would think. Because I think they read charts and write deficiencies based on charts a lot more in this area than they write deficiencies based on 2 hours worth of observations, because 2 hours worth of observations is hard to do. It's a long view. So I think you'd be safer having a very specific care plan than a non-specific care plan. But I'm telling you, it's very difficult to predict which is the safest thing to do. In this case, I've elected to go with a fairly specific care plan. Let's go to the next slide. It's come up on several occasions what a care plan should look like for somebody who is not going to be on a toilet for. Because obviously there's a new emphasis on this. I mean, the new MDS is going to ask you, if you put people on a trial toileting program, they're going to ask you know, why you're not going to put them on a toileting program if you're not. So there's obviously going to be more survey attention to this. But again, let me say it would be a clear mistake, probably a great flag warning, if you had everybody on a toileting program. Because the simple truth is, not everybody's going to be responsive to a toileting program. If you put everybody on one, it's going to look suspicious, highly suspicious. And nobody wants it, not everybody's responsive. So let's say you do a 3-day trial, and you get a patient that looks like this, who's not responsive to toileting. Here's my suggested language. A resident was prompted every 2 hours and given choice to use the bathroom with the probability protocol reference to the interpretive guidelines. Same language, because I think they're both worth mentioning every time. The resident never asked for choice and appeared to be bothered by efforts to encourage her to toilet. The resident was wet 3 times per day with no clear time pattern. I get you at the pattern. The resident also did not express motivation during interviews for further treatment for her UI and agreed with the plan to manage her incontinence with the Chase protocol, in which she would get checked about every 2 hours and shaved for a bit. Resident expressed a preference to not be disturbed at night. He's sleeping. You get all that information either from your 3-day assessment or from the preference interview that you do. The suggested language for this care plan is residents be checked and changed when wet during waking hours or when observed to be awake at night. She'll be allowed to sleep for up to 6 hours a night without disturbance or incontinence care, since that is her preference, and she is not at high risk for skin breakdown.
Again, you've moved to the next slide.
Suggested language for care plans, moving on to the reported care plan. However, her skin will be checked daily by aides to assess potential problems from wetness exposure. Now, of course, if she is at high risk for skin breakdown, you all of a sudden go into a real cloudy head. If you hear somebody telling you they don't want to be woken up every couple hours, but yet they're at high risk for skin breakdown, then you have to make some balanced judgment between what's worse, not adhering to the resident's preference or not changing them every 2 hours. I think you'd be safe doing either as long as you acknowledge this was attention. And that you're going to do one or the other, that you're going to let her sleep because that's your preference to check the skin routinely and carefully, or you're going to wake her up every 2 hours to counter to her preference. Because, in fact, you're too worried about her skin. The reality is, to be quite frank, whenever we have tried to do in our studies, whenever we really have tried to get to people every couple hours during the night, they got very disturbed. I don't know what your care plan say goes on at night. But if you really try to implement a care plan where something happens every 2 hours from midnight to the next morning, our experience has been patients get very upset with that. So I don't know if you can do it even if you care plan. Anyway, what I suggest is in this care plan, if it went along with the assessment, should clearly cover all the bases for why you've analyzed this patient's incontinence and analyzed in a way to suggest that a clothing or rehabilitation program is not justified or called for even in this manner based on the resident's preference. Again, it's hard for me to imagine how you get a deficiency written for a patient with this kind of assessment and this kind of care plan language. Finally, this goes to the last one. Next slide now. I finally got it. Suggested language assessment for somebody's urge and comments. This was the previous question that was asked after the last lecture. Remember, you are supposed to list the type of incontinence, and I told you that during that 3-day trial, you can do so. Before I get into the care plan, the basic types of urge incontinence where somebody feels the urge to void, but they just can't wait to get to the toilet to do it. Stress incontinence, where somebody leaks every time they lift them or move them or when they cough, which you can see as you're moving them around for changing or toileting, or functional incontinence, which basically means that the only reason they're incontinent is they can't get to the bathroom. And it's that kind of person, well, people with mild stress and urge incontinence, and just extremely low well possibility without anything else. But there are patients who need something else. So this is an example. So resident was prompted every 2 hours for 3 days to your trial and given choice to use the toilet with possibility protocol referenced in the interpretive guidelines. Resident expressed high motivation to bring an interview to regain confidence and said yes every time toilet assistance was offered. The resident successfully toileted 4 times per day, but continued to also be wet every 2 hours. It was clear that the resident showed symptoms of urge incontinence since she was often unable to delay bleeding while being assisted to the floor, and in fact said she could not make it before losing her urine. So this is a classic urge incontinence. And here's somebody who wants to be dry, who will say yes to you every time you attempt to take her to the toilet, but despite all his efforts, still is wet in between times, and still has all kind of urgency as you do. So I think the assessment language should be, she would refer to her physician for further evaluation and for consideration of medical treatment for your urgent incontinence. I don't know how sophisticated your physicians are for treating incontinence, but most physicians at least know about the medications for urinary incontinence, mostly are for urge. Somebody brought up occupational therapy. If you have an occupational therapist, you could refer them there. They might be experts at doing bladder drills or Kegel exercises. But the other thing that you could do is an adjunct to continuity. But in this case, it's so you refer to the physician. So the care plan then would be...
Next slide.
Next slide, yes. Resident was ordered medication X. I didn't say the medication, did prepare, that's one of those typically used nowadays, for urgent incontinence after consultation with the physician, and will be offered toileting assistance every 2 hours since she also requires supervision to safely toilet. Her incontinence will be monitored daily to evaluate progress with improvement being documented if she is wet less than one time a day. I put that last phrase in there because if there is medical treatment, if there's something more invasive, coming from urinary incontinence, they usually want some specific goals in mind that would reflect progress on how you're going to track progress. So I put that last phrase in there for that. In summary, do these care plans absolutely cover everything you're supposed to cover? Well, the answer is no. Do they cover more and better than any care plans or assessments that we've ever seen since we've been doing this work in nursing homes? Clearly, yes. And they do. We've never seen one this good that covers this many illness. Would they, in every case, past survey review? Probably not, because of the subjective nature of the survey process. But I can say this, if you're in a deficiency because of the care plan, you'd be in great shape, because you would be already exceeded what most nursing homes do in this area. It should give you as much protection from what I think is an arbitrary and subjective survey process as you're ever going to get if you had language like this. So I definitely suggest that you take your 3-day you take your preference interviews that you've been doing, and you take your 3-day trial of toileting assistance, which already has documentation and all this stuff. But summarize it up in a narrative form like I just did. And if you do that, and have it placed prominently in the chart, I think there is an excellent chance that you'll do well in the survey. I should say a word about that, prominence of the chart. I wouldn't just have these things place somewhere where they're difficult to find. When a surveyor starts looking for this stuff, the more clearly and visible they are, the less likely they're really going to start looking at other things. So I would make it real up front and real clear, so it's one of the first things that they see. The next slide is how we typically end. It's some of the quiz results and the discussion of these points. So one of the questions we ask you is, a resident's responsiveness to continence avoidance may best be determined based on, and what are the alternatives? 4% of people took functional performance tests, 2 said cognitive, 54% said brief trial continence avoidance, and 40% said any one of the above. That last one in particular, a lot of people check, and I don't think they should have, because it's pretty clear that both functional performance tests and cognitive performance tests are not good ways of determining somebody's responsiveness to cognitive avoidance. A 3-day trial by far away is the best. In fact, we'll be publishing an article soon that says people with lower cognitive functioning actually do somewhat better on cognitive avoidance than people with higher cognitive function. There's a limit. And people with low cognitive function obviously can't do well. But just because you're fairly severely impaired cognitively does not mean that you can't do pretty well with cognitive avoidance or schizophrenia. So the answer to the question is that the brief trial of cognitive avoidance is by far and away the best way to determine whether a resident is responsible. typically, I'll target less than a third of the time, 3% of you check that, about half the time, 22% check that, 70% or 2/3 of the time, 70% check that, always 5%. The right answer is C, more than 2/3 of the time, but I guess it depends on what your criteria is. And we suggest a 66% appropriate chlorine ratio during a 3-day trial to keep people on a proper voiding or chlorine program. And if you're at 66% of the chlorine ratio, that means that they'll use the toilet 2/3 of the time. So the most responsible of those to do that. I personally, unless it was one of the extremely strong preference to do so, I wouldn't keep a patient on a proper voiding program who was wet half the time. That's too much. I mean, something else is going on. They either have some medical problem that needs to be treated, they're just not motivated enough. I don't know. So unless it's an extremely strong preference to keep their food, I wouldn't do it if they're wet half the time. That's too much and too complicated. The last question. Which of the following, the next slide, quiz results and discussion, number 7. Which of the following strategies can make it more feasible for facilities to provide prompted voiding? Forego often prompted voiding at nighttime. Integrate prompted voiding with interventions that enhance residents' mobility. 70% of you check that. Reduce the number of daytime hours during which prompted voiding is offered. 0% of you check that. All of the above. 24% check that. This is a more argumentative question, I guess. I've actually seen nursing homes who have done all of the above. In fact, that's typically what they do. The problem is, depending on how you're staffed, on the 3 to 11 shift, if your staffing ratio drops significantly, it just might not be possible to continue prompted voiding with everybody that you just did it with on the day shift when you have more staff there. You might have to reduce the number of hours or promote prompted voiding with at least some people during nighttime, depending on how your shift changes, your ratios change from 7 to 3, 3 to 11, 11 to 7. Clearly, though, if you're offering chlorine assistance to somebody, this clearly gives you the opportunity, if they will take it, it clearly gives the opportunity to give them some mobility exercise, because in transferring somebody to the toilet or sitting over the toilet, that gives you an excellent opportunity to have the person do as much of that walking and transferring as they possibly can with assistance. And if they can stand, it gives you the opportunity to actually have them do a couple stands extra after the chlorine event, just for exercise. We've done that in previous trials. We call it functional support training. And when we did it that way, there were improvements in residents' physical functioning and a reduction in the number of residents showing ADL decline, simply because of the incidental exercise that went along with the prompted bleeding. So not necessary to do really intense types of exercise to prevent mobility decline in this group. And if you do a little bit of exercise with each toilet event 3 or 4 times a day, that's sufficient and it works. So it's a very excellent way to maximize your time efficiency. Because most of the time involved in putting a lot of time in it, and providing toilet assistance is finding somebody getting there and dropping other things. So while you're there, it's always smart to do as much as you possibly can. Okay, Annie,
I know I've got a couple of other questions that people emailed me or called me with that are for you. Before we do that, before we go to questions and answers, I just want to remind everybody that our next teleconference is going to be May 12th, and we want you to keep trialing incontinent residents as new admissions or other residents that you feel would be appropriate candidates for prompted voiding. And then send us those assessment results on that resident assessment data form. I'm looking for those. I've gotten a number of them from a number of facilities. There's some facilities where we still don't have any. If you have to go really slow, if you're having trouble getting residents assessed, I have told a few nursing homes that if you had a very motivated nurse aide, and Jack, maybe you can comment on this, and you have those pocket cards, you could, if you couldn't do anything else, is give that nurse aide those three pocket cards and tell her or him, try this with a resident, come back and let's discuss it. At least it will get you started. So if you haven't made progress there, that's one strategy for breaking it down, making it really simple. But I do want to open the floor to questions and answers. I wanted to ask, Candy had a question from last time or a couple of comments. If she's out there, you could log in with #6, Candy, if you're out there. Otherwise, I'm going to open it up. I think you had some comments from last time. Okay. I'm going to give you a couple questions that we have from others, and then if you have more questions, please log in with #6. Jack, we had one question about how often do you have to do the 3-day trial? I mean, you might do it at admission for an incontinent resident. Do you have to do it again at any other time, and if so, what time would that be?
Theoretically, if you read the guidelines, you have to do it for a change in condition. But, if you did something on admission for a resident, if you did 3-day trial on admission, and you did a lot of responses, and then they got worse, there clearly would be no reason to repeat the 3-day trial. It's not going to change. You would only repeat it if for some reason they got better. So for instance, if they checked in and they were delirious and had an infection and kind of got over it real weak and they didn't do too well, and over the next 3 to 6 months they got a lot stronger, they might want to repeat it. But otherwise, you don't have to repeat the 3-day assessment quarterly or even on a yearly basis unless there's justification for doing it.
Okay. And somebody else wrote in and said that the program was working so well that some residents were trying to get up and use the toilet by themselves, and so as a result they were having a slightly higher incidence of falls.
Well, we've not seen that. I don't know what to say about that. I would look to see where they have urgent costs. I mean, if aides are offering assistance on a 2-hour basis, and if they're answering call lights with a fair degree of 5-10 minute delay, a resident should be able to get assistance before they go to the toilet. They should only, it's not really very neat resident anyway, which many of them are. It's not great that they try to get to the toilet on their own. So I would try to look at for those patients, whether they might have an urgency issue that prevents them from waiting the 2 hours or prevents them from waiting even the brief duration of time it takes between the time you put on a call light and the time somebody gets there. And if they have urgent comments, I mean, if they have that symptom where they say, I can't hold it, once I feel it, I don't have any time, I gotta get there. I mean, if they're saying stuff like that, then I would consider a referral. So that they can have more control over how long they can hold it.
Okay. And the question about documentation, I think also if Jeanette's out there, she can clarify it for me. Again, to log in, it's #6 to unmute your phone. But do nurse aides at the bedside need to document toileting assistance every time? I mean, if your care plan says that you're going to take the resident to the toilet every 2 hours, I think one participant's question was, you know, they're having trouble documenting that level of care at the bedside on a daily basis. They were using Care Tracker, and I think some of the nurse aides just were not finding the time to get to the Care Tracker login station to record that. So
most of the documentation that we see is not done every 2 hours. Most of the documentation regarding this is done at the end of the shift.
Yeah.
And basically have some kind of statement like closed times 3, closed times 4, whatever. Something like that. And that passes survey muster, and if they have something like that. In my experience for this one, is that if you know, low line deficiency for a non-specific care plan, low line deficiency is big. That's not individualized, there's choice and so on. But only write a deficiency for not closing somebody if they do an observation and see it not being done. They don't do it because of attendance or absence of actually written documentation. We'll take, you know, 12 times 3, 12 times 4, whatever.
Okay.
But the bigger danger is when they show up for a couple hours and they see somebody not getting incontinence care yet they're with.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question. I don't think you have to come every 2 hours. A care tracker.